Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we certainly can reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. And isn't this a beautiful day? I have some stories here from the Good Old Days magazine about times that weren't quite so beautiful. Here's one entitled, A Kid's Eye View of Hard Times. Life wasn't as tough for her as she thought at the time. This was sent in by Judith Mabey. It's difficult to view myself as having grown up in hard times in the 1950s in Long Beach, California, when the biggest disappointment I faced as a young child, and thought of as deprivation, was that we did not have a fenced yard, and Mother couldn't afford to fence the yard or buy me a dog like Lassie or Big Red. When I was a bit older, though, I recall having to call Joe Van Kutren, an older man, a year older than me, to tell him I couldn't take him to that spring's backward dance, which was when the girls asked the guys out. The dance wasn't on April Fool's Day, but I was an April Fool for Joe. I just couldn't afford to take him to the dance and out to dinner at De Palma's Little Italy like I wanted to. I breathed a sigh of relief when his mother said he was sorry he couldn't go anyway because he had to work. But I think I realized just how poor Mother was when, at the age of 11 or 12, I pulled up a chair and sat next to her to watch her pay the monthly bills. She went down the list of bills she had to pay for the month, starting with the mortgage, the electric bill, the gas bill, and the water bill. I don't recall whether she had a charge account at Sears or Penny's, but she did have to pay Seaboard Finance Company for a personal loan for school clothes for the five of us the previous year. After the bills were paid, what was left was used to pay for groceries for 2 weeks. I did sit up and take notice of the butternut candy bars for a nickel that I had bought when I was the one who went to the grocery store. But Mother never chastised me for doing so. Maybe she didn't bother to count the change. More likely, she realized that she, too, liked to splurge now and then on a cube of real butter rather than margarine for popcorn on a rare Friday night, or when she made potato dumplings when the grocery money ran out. Potatoes were cheap. So, how did I help out? Well, first of all, I should say that I didn't help much with anything at a very young age, because my older sisters did the housework. I was reduced to fetching the dustpan when the housekeeper among us didn't have it in hand. When I was about 6, another older sister was a little more confident that I was capable of helping with the housework, and she taught me how to clean the bathroom sink, shiny clean. My older sisters were very capable. They either moved out when they graduated from high school, or if they didn't move out, they paid their share of rent to Mother. As I got older, about 14, I think, I really would have preferred to just sing and read, but I did have one babysitting job that I got because one of my sisters had it before me. However, I was fired because I didn't do more than the dishes after feeding the two boys or vacuum the rug like my sister had done. That couple's home held my weakness, a family room with a whole wall of books to read. I did look for a job at Newberry's dime store when I turned 16, but Gloria Aylman got the job. My difficulties with looking for work didn't continue after I graduated from high school, but I did encounter a problem when I had my first interview. Mother decided to move with me to Cocoa Beach, Florida, where my sister was working for the Corps of Engineers. I saw an ad in the paper for a job as a clerk typist working for NASA in their office at Patrick Air Force Base. So I took the bus down Highway A1A, applied as directed, and took the typing test. I passed with flying colors. But when the engineer talked to me, he told me they couldn't hire me because, he said rather apologetically, "You're only 17 and you're not of legal age." I thanked him anyway and left. That was when I decided that the school system in California had not done me any favors when they advanced me to first grade after discovering that I could read in kindergarten. The following weekend, my sister and I were at a little coffee shop having breakfast. As we left, she spotted a man she recognized who worked next door at a finance company. She introduced me and told him that I was looking for a job. He told me to come in the next day. I filled out an application, and they hired me on the spot. I reported for work the following morning. And this was A Kid's Eye View of Hard Times by Judith Mabee. This next story is entitled Paying Bills Was a Social Event. Just like her father, she looked forward to taking care of business with her own checks. This was written and sent in by Arlene Schovald. I was fresh out of high school when I took a job at a children's clothing store in my hometown of Iron River, Michigan, in 1958. It wasn't my first job. I had already been working for a couple of years as a waitress at a local restaurant and as a car hop at the A&W root beer stand. But I never saw checks at those places. So when a classmate made a purchase with a check at the clothing store, I thought that was the ultimate sign of adulthood. "How do you get a checking account?" I asked. I was told, "Just go to the bank." So I did, and I was very proud to have a checking account. Debts were paid with cash or checks then. Credit cards came later. The history of checks goes back to the 1500s in Holland. Amsterdam was a major shipping and trading center then, and people who had money deposited it with a cashier to keep it safe. Then they paid for their purchase with a note, and the cashier released the money. Flash forward about 400 years or so, and checks and cash were still the main way of paying bills, which for my dad was a social event. We lived in the country, and he enjoyed going to town after work or on a Saturday to pay the water bill at the town hall, the electric bill at the Upper Peninsula Power Company, and especially the tab at the grocery store, where people were allowed to sign a slip and then make good for the bill on payday. Most of the men worked in one of the many iron mines that were operating in Iron County at that time. Very few women worked or drove. In fact, it was almost considered a bad thing for a married woman, especially one with children, to be in the workforce as anything other than a nurse or a teacher. While walking around town and paying bills, my dad got to visit with friends, learn about the current politics, and sometimes get involved with issues like saving the town hall from being torn down. When I was still living at home during high school and a year after graduation, I saved just about every penny I earned to get married. That happened on June 20th, 1959. My wedding dress and veil cost about $60, which was more than 2 weeks' pay. I was working at the local J.J. Newberry store then. I stayed there until I was about 8 months pregnant and was asked to leave. Women who were expecting were not to be seen in public in those days, so I settled into being a housewife and a mother. Since we had only one car, I was trapped at home, a mile out of town, and that checking account I had opened a few years earlier came in handy for paying bills. I rarely got to town, so I would write a check, put it in an addressed and stamped envelope, put the envelope in our roadside rural route mailbox, and put up the little red flag. The mailman took care of the rest. And this was Paying Bills Was a Social Event by Arlene Chauvault. This next story is entitled Simply Charming, a gift from her dad that made her 16th birthday special is still worn around her wrist. And this story was written and sent in by Sarah Etkin Baker. Long before life's memorable moments were posted on social media, they were embedded in charm bracelets. Charm bracelets have been around for centuries and existed long before written history, with the first ones dating back to ancient Egypt. Evidence suggests that later ones were a part of European culture as early as the 1400s. Many of us find charm bracelets, even modern ones, irresistibly charming. And why is that? Is it their tradition and millennia-long history? Is it the jingle-jangle a charm bracelet makes when the wearer is in motion? Is it the fascination of getting up close and personal to examine each charm hanging from the links and hearing the stories behind the individual charms? Whatever the reason, charm bracelets were in their heyday in the 1950s and 60s and were a big craze for young girls and teenagers like me. A multitude of charms were available representing friendship, birthdays, graduations, hobbies, summer vacations, school supplies, Sweet 16, going steady, and much more. Owning a charm bracelet was a rite of passage for us, and receiving one was cause for much celebration. So, imagine my delight when Dad gave me my first charm bracelet on my 16th birthday. It boasted two charms, a Sweet 16 charm and a four-leaf clover Happy Birthday charm with a tiny red garnet, my birthstone. On my 17th birthday, he added a You're an Angel charm to my bracelet. On my 18th birthday, he gave me another Happy Birthday charm containing an even bigger red garnet. Many of my teenage friends added to their bracelets as they grew into womanhood, adding charms chronicling their graduation, engagement, marriage, honeymoon, anniversaries, births of children, travel, hobbies, and careers. But unlike my friends, I never added charms to my original Sweet 16 charm bracelet. I'm not sure why. When I ventured off to college, I wrapped my charm bracelet in tissue paper and tucked it inside my jewelry box, safe and secure. The years thereafter rapidly unfolded, and I rarely thought about my charm bracelet. It was truly out of sight and out of mind. Yet somehow my teenage jewelry box and original bracelet miraculously survived, accompanying me through countless moves over the past 50-plus years. I recently found the vintage jewelry box and discovered my Sweet 16 charm bracelet inside, untarnished and neatly wrapped in the original protective white tissue paper that has now yellowed with age. I gingerly placed the bracelet around my wrist and locked the clasp. Remembering Dad and revisiting the experiences we shared and the memories we made. At this point in my life, I wish I had added to my Sweet 16 charm bracelet, for there's no other piece of jewelry that acts as a time post and records a woman's life quite like a charm bracelet. Charms are tokens of treasured moments that reveal the passage of time and the journey a woman has taken. Call me sentimental, but I liken them to wearing a photo album full of happy memories swinging from my wrist. They're certainly far less cumbersome than retrieving my photo albums from my closet shelf to revisit some of my most precious memories. Fortunately, charms and charm bracelets have experienced a resurgence in popularity, meaning a host of charms are available that would allow me to add charms to my Sweet 16 bracelet, charms depicting my life's journey. But my life has been abundantly filled with so many experiences, it would be difficult to select the charms. So for now, I choose not to add to my original charm bracelet. I occasionally wear it. When I do, someone invariably notices it jingling from my wrist. Enchanted with the uncluttered bracelet with its four simple charms, and we strike up a conversation. Despite its age and simplicity, my charm bracelet remains my favorite and most enchanting piece of jewelry. It is simply charming. And this was Simply Charming by Sarah Etkin Baker. This next story is entitled Hard Times Party. Any reason was a good reason for this family to get together. This was sent in by Ruth Smith. There was going to be a party. In the height of the Depression during the 1930s, this did not happen often. But it was Uncle Doc's birthday, and a party was called for. My dad's brother, Uncle Doc, a master carpenter, was one of the many out-of-work people throughout the country. There weren't too many mansions being built those days on the Gold Coast of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where his skills were appreciated but currently underutilized. My dad had a job, but Uncle Doc and his tiny, worrisome wife, Martha, were on relief. Once a week, Uncle Doc rolled out the old red coaster wagon to go to the relief station in their area, where he and other unemployed workers would receive food from the county for the week. There would be excess cheese, a smattering of meat, seasonal vegetables, and pantry staples. Unbelievably, there often was veal, and if there was, my uncle would whip up a recipe of Sulze, a German delicacy, which he would share with the family. Snow had fallen the day before the party, which was great fun for a 7-year-old like me. However, on the cold Saturday night of the party, I was bundled up in warm clothing and a heavy woolen blanket, and then propped in the wooden box atop my sled. I was entrusted to hold the coconut cake Mom had made, Uncle Doc's favorite and Mom's specialty. Dad was the power to pull the delivery. Stars twinkled, and there were few cars along the way. By the time we covered the mile to the party house, we were warm and ready for the festivities. As each relative arrived at the modest wooden home on Clark Street, there were lots of laughs, as this was a hard times party. Everyone had scrounged their oldest and most decrepit clothes to wear for the occasion. Uncle Doc took the prize with a pair of overalls tattered at the knees and topped by a faded red sweater held together by a number of safety pins. Aunt Martha kept apologizing for the outfit, but it was all in fun. I looked like an orphan in the old clothes Mom had pulled out of our rag bag. Then it was time for the ladies to settle in to play serious games of bunco in the parlor, while the men took over the kitchen for the traditional shuffkopf game. The hotly contested game was played for nickels, but you'd better be on your toes if you were Grandpa Otto's partner. Winning hands were slapped atop the kitchen table to growls from the losers, and Grandpa never failed to cuss out his partner if they lost a hand. Bunco was taken seriously, too. The winner for the night would go home with a hand-embroidered dish towel made from a recycled flour sack. The absolute loser earned a bottle of homemade ketchup. Bunco came to a halt when it was time to put out the goodies everyone had brought for the late-night supper. Grandma's German potato salad was always a feature. There was rye bread to be slathered with the pound of raw beef someone had splurged 50 cents on, topped with thinly sliced onions. And don't forget the sulza. Aunt Bertha's plump dill pickles and Aunt Anna's baked beans were added, and it seemed the table wouldn't hold one more item. Mrs. Zelinka, Aunt Martha's sweet elderly neighbor, and practically one of the family, had brought her mouth-watering kolaches. They were filled with strawberry preserves, custard, or my least favorite, prune puree. It was my job to whip the cream that would dollop each kolache. Donning an extra sweater, I was set up on a step in the cold back hall with a rectangular metal whipper handle on the side. It seemed like it took forever to whip the cream, but the completed kolache was so scrumptious. And don't forget the coconut birthday cake. The men reluctantly stopped the Shopkopf tournament, and we enjoyed each specialty, sang happy birthday to Uncle Doc, and stuffed ourselves. Then it was time to bundle up for the walk home. By the time we reached the first corner, I was fast asleep in my wooden chariot. Good times were included at a hard times party. And this was Hard Times Party by Ruth G. Smith. Now here's an item from the Bits and Pieces section of the Good Old Days magazine. It's entitled, Cooking in the Not-So-Long-Ago Old Days. Some cold gray day, when you need a cup of hot tea and a good chuckle, find yourself one of your old cookbooks and sit down for a few minutes of culinary wisdom, not meant to be humorous. My former kitchen Bible was the New York Times cookbook. I haven't consulted it in years, having culled out a few recipes I now know by heart, but I keep it on the shelf because it looks familiar and is war-weary with use, and it's very sentimental to me. It's a relic of former days of feeding a family of six and of dinner parties of at least 10 guests. Thank goodness I no longer do large dinner parties. The quantity of heavy cream, sugar, and especially butter called for in those old recipes could and probably did clog the arteries of my loved ones and guests for years. saintly cooks with beatific smiles of pleasure at setting a good table could also have served time in prison for the early demise of the well-fed partakers of that cuisine. When I think of friends and family throughout the years who've had serious health problems, I wonder what my contribution was. Have another piece of pie? Would you like the recipe for this buttery dessert? This was after a cheese appetizer and a heavily marbled hunk of beef. I do remember beef being a prime feature of my menus, and heavy cream and 2 pounds of butter were staples in my refrigerator. It's no wonder people think fondly of the taste of Mom's home cooking. Hollandaise sauce, Bernaise sauce, and the buttery taste of everything made even overcooked vegetables and tough meat taste delicious. As one of my recipes said, serve the steak with melted butter, seasoned to taste. The desserts, of course, were confections that made the fat and calorie-laden temptations on today's restaurant menus sound like those for health-conscious hardcore dieters. Let's add a word about salt. Add is a key word here. Can you find a recipe in one of the older cookbooks that doesn't call for at least a teaspoonful? Salt brought out the flavor and raised the blood pressure of all of my friends and family. I would hang my head in shame, but it's what I was fed at their houses, too. I know that today's health-conscious recipes are very tasty. But in the secret recesses of your mind, don't you wish the health authorities would say, "It's been a huge mistake. Go back to your old ways of eating, fast food to foie gras. It's good for you." And this was Cooking in the Not So Long Ago Old Days, written and sent in by Barbara Hughes. On the last page of the magazine, the editor has posted this item. This month on the Good Old Days Facebook page, people are sharing all sorts of wonderful memories. See some of the fun below and be sure to join us at facebook.com/goodolddaysmag. Take a look. Well, thanks for joining me. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.